My name's Madeline Morris. I'm a reporter with 7:30, and I've been hosting this series of Q&A sessions called Question Time here at the Wheeler Centre. We've had some great ones over the past couple of months, and very big subject for us to tackle tonight in an hour. We are, of course, talking about transport, which has got to be one of the most vexed issues of public policy and personal lives. It's where the public policy really intersects with the personal on a very deep and profound level, as anyone who's tried to come over the Westgate at 8 a.m. will tell you. So tonight is about questions and getting some answers to your questions. We've got a really fantastic panel here tonight. I'll get our guests tonight to introduce themselves, and we'll start with Amandine.
Thanks. So my name is Amandine Dennis, and I'm Head of Research at ClimateWorks Australia, which is a not-for-profit organisation with a mission to help catalyse significant emissions reductions in Australia. And what might be interesting to you today is that we've done some analysis recently on how we can reduce carbon emissions from cars on the road today, but also what is required in the longer term if we really want to keep global warming below 2 degrees.
Thank you. John Daly, I'm Chief Executive at the Grattan Institute, which does research on pressing policy problems and then talks about them in public. We have particularly had a cities program for the last couple of years that's talked a lot about the shape of our cities and obviously the way that transport influences the shape and the productivity, the fairness of our cities. And we've also done a lot of work on Australian government budgets, because the bottom line is that somebody has to pay for transport, and understanding where it fits in the scheme of other priorities, how much money we're going to have for it and how we might prioritise that is a topic near and dear to my heart.
And my name's John Stone. I'm a lecturer in transport planning at the University of Melbourne. And my particular interest is in how we build public transport systems which work in the middle and outer suburbs of Australian cities, using a lot of the examples of cities in Canada and German-speaking Europe particularly, where they've been able to build public transport systems that are efficient and effective in low-density environments like we have in our suburbs. And I think there's a lot of opportunities for us to learn from that experience to make sure that we can have affordable public transport systems which meet people's needs much better than the car-based systems that we have at the moment.
My name's Ang Haradwin-Jones. I'm creative producer at Arts House, which is based in North Melbourne. And I feel like I'm a little bit of an interloper here, because I have virtually no knowledge of transport facts, but I am interested deeply in the role that art can play in transforming the way that we think about how we can live sustainably. And I'm involved in another organisation called Tipping Point Australia that catalyses conversations around that topic. And just this coming weekend, we have an event called Going Nowhere, excitingly, which is looking at international artists exchanging without getting on a plane. So I suppose we're trying to rehearse what the world might look like or feel like without excessive use of plane flights, because as anyone that's ever done their carbon footprint knows, as soon as you put in an international flight, you've kind of blown it.
Well, while we wait for the first question, I'm going to ask a thorny question of my own. I'll ask you, John, first of all, I think it's kind of a fact that our transport system is broken. Why is it broken? Is there a reason for it? Are there multiple reasons?
There's multiple reasons, but the main one is that we're trying to use a technology which takes a lot of space, cars, to do something which needs, in environments where we need to have space for a lot of other purposes. So we use 30% or more of the land area of the city for car parking and roads, and that makes it very difficult to have all the other things that we want to have in the city. We want people to be able to work close together, all of the people to be able to interact. And the freedom that cars are supposed to offer when you have a lot of them trying to do the same thing at the same time is evaporating, and so now we have congestion at peak time levels on weekends, and so people are finding that they can't do the things that they wanted to do with a car. So that's basically the problem, and we need to find other ways of minimising the need for travel and finding other options of how we get around.
Have I been too presumptuous? Is there anyone who doesn't think that our transport system is broken? No. Dead silence there. Why do you think our transport system is broken, John?
I think one of the big issues is around the way that we choose or don't choose the projects to do. I mean, the big cost in transport, one of the very large costs, is the large infrastructure builds we've got, and whether that's an east-west link or a metro or whatever it might be. That's where we spend a lot of the money. And if you look at the process that we're using at the moment, it's about as broken as any process I can think of in our political and policy life at the moment. If you look at the projects that were given money for the first time in the budget the Commonwealth Government delivered in May 2014, not a single dollar went to a project that had been given a green light by Infrastructure Australia. So that's the thing that's supposed to prioritise these projects. And not one project that it had prioritised actually got any money. So at that point, you know that the process is completely broken. I dare say we'll talk about East-West in due course, but there's a whole series of things, not around just that project, but any number of projects where it appears we're not doing the right kind of planning thinking, the analysis that's done is not terrific, and then the prioritisation analysis that's done is very poor. And the bottom line is we can't build all of the transport projects we'd like to build. The budget just will not go that far. It doesn't matter how much financial jiggery-pokery you do. Sooner or later, someone's got to pay for it. And there's not that much money in the tin to build everything we'd love to build. And what that means then is there's a real priority, a real focus, or should be a real focus on prioritisation, and that process has essentially broken down.
So what would you, Amandine, if you were prioritising, if you were writing the federal government budget for next year, what would you be prioritising, or even the state government budget, what would you be prioritising?
Well, from our perspective, for sure, the priorities should be around making the system more sustainable in the long run, right? So there's a number of measures which would make a lot of sense. And even outside of the budget, what we find is that today Australia's cars are some of the least efficient in the whole world. And you don't need to spend a lot of budget money to improve this. We could simply implement fuel efficiency standard, which pretty much all other countries in the world have, to save a really big amount of money, both for businesses and for individuals. So that would definitely be one of the things that we would prioritise. But also, I mean, I'm not an expert in this, but making sure that there's the right infrastructure for public transport so that people can have choices in the way they choose to travel would definitely be quite important. Making sure, for example, that people have the option of taking the train instead of commuting by car, or potentially instead of taking the plane. So there's been a few projects looking at how we could actually create, for example, a fast train in between the large capital cities on the East Coast. So there's a lot of opportunities that are currently untapped and that could deliver carbon emissions reductions as well as cost savings for everyone.
But really touched on it there where you said it's about choices. And fundamentally, humans, we just love choice, and particularly I think in Australia we love the choice, and one of our most deeply ingrained choices is to drive. And if we lived in China, I imagine that we could just say, okay, only people with even number plates go out today and people with odd number plates go out tomorrow, because they don't have that choice. But we do have that fundamental choice here. I don't know how you actually make a system where you say to people, we're going to, in some ways, reduce the choice that you have to drive.
I'm wondering whether it's about the actual experience of public transport, shifting the way that we think about what that is, rather than simply a kind of functional thing of getting from A to B, that it actually becomes an experience that is different, but the same kind of quality that people have in a car, because I think people are very attached to their personal space. We were talking earlier about people using their cars for all sorts of things, storage, you know, reading time, time away from the family. There's a whole other sort of series of emotional attachments to that choice. And I'm wondering if we actually thought about the way that we experience commuting together whether that's on a bus or on a train, and actually enhance that experience aesthetically and emotionally.
So how would you do that? Because commuting can be fairly hard.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, people try to do that. I've been on a couple of train rides where the bus driver has told this fantastic story just, you know, because he can and because he's got the, you know, the sound equipment there. And the whole carriage has been completely ignited by that. And, it, you know, it actually then feels like you're part of a community. There's a function to why you're travelling and how who you're travelling with. So, I mean, that's a, you know, a really small thing, but to actually enable that. And people here, I'm sure, remember the tram conductors and what a kind of incredible network of information they were about a whole series of how to navigate the city way beyond the transport system itself.
I remember catching a London Tube home on Christmas Eve, and out of nowhere, tube driver broke into Jingle Bells, Jingle Bells, the entire way from Covent Garden to Piccadilly. And
where's my car? I want to get out of it.
No, it was fantastic. I loved it. And those sorts of creating those communities, because at the moment we think about our commute, our transport, as being getting from one place of community to another place of community. Mm. So either our home to work or wherever. But are we thinking about it in the wrong way? Is it a potential for community?
Yeah, I would say absolutely. And, you know, I mean, that it's sort of an unexplored, unacknowledged reality, I think, that you know that you're sitting, you know, with people and you might see them every day at the same time, and you might get to know your station master or mistress. But, yes, it feels to me like there's a whole underexplored area of, you know, inviting artists into that mix and creating experiences where people actually would choose to do that, not because they've been enforced by, you know, odd or even registration plates, but because it's actually something that is fun to do.
Yes. Just the lady behind you, first of all, and then we'll come to you, sir.
Hello. I just want to bring you up a little bit or cut you short a little bit about your idea of choice. Because in fact, if you don't live within 800 meters of a train station, you don't have a choice about ownership of a vehicle. Mm. And that is the greatest single point of lameness in our system of public transport, that in fact, that you have to own a motor vehicle in order to access it. The grave majority of people in this city who live in the interstitial zones cannot get to a train station without owning a car.
Sure. So and we're taking away that the choice isn't even there in the first place.
So this is your idea of choice. I would say to you about 7/8 of dwellers in the greater Melbourne metropolitan area don't have a choice to own a vehicle.
That's a very, yeah. very good point. Excellent yeah. point.
I,
yeah.
I would absolutely.
Was that going to be your point? Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Because I think where we do have people using their cars less, it's where they are offered choices. Mm-hmm. And all these new technologies, Uber and bike shares and car shares and all of those things, they're all going to come into the inner city where people already have choices. It's just like trying to find a taxi in a far-flung part of Melbourne. The taxi drivers don't go there because most people have cars. There's very few people going to make the choice of taking a taxi. So it's exactly right. And what's really an interesting comparison is the middle suburbs of somewhere like Toronto in Canada, where bus routes are designed to run directly to railway stations. The use of public transport in those suburbs, which are, in terms of their structure, you know, single occupancy households, densities that's very similar to ours, they're very much, much higher, 3 and 4 times the levels that we have. So it's getting people the choice so that the step to take to go out of your house doesn't involve finding the car keys.
So what's the fundamental difference then between this Canadian approach? What's the difference in mentality in the government approach there?
Well, they have actually, I mean, they've ran into neoliberal problems in the 90s in the same way that we have, but their big successes were in the 50s and 60s as car use started to grow, where the transport agencies didn't just throw up their hands and say, we've lost. They said, what sort of public transport system would work for those people? And that's one which actually, in frequency, speed, connections, that's the mantra that makes a public transport work in the suburbs. And you can do it in suburbs of low densities. And that's really where we have to start investing. So we don't have bus occupancy rates of less than one person per passenger kilometre, which is what we have in the buses that are running around the suburbs of Melbourne. It would be interesting for people to live even in the inner city. You might have a bus route that goes past the end of your street, but how many people know where that bus goes? How much does that bus advertise its own route, or how much does it sort of operate in, you know, sort of spaghetti spirals? And the Auditor General has pointed out how poorly coordinated our services are, and that's where we need to make the effort.
But I think we shouldn't assume that car use is necessarily bad. It's worth remembering that particularly in the suburbs, and particularly when you're trying to get from point A in the suburbs to point B in the suburbs, you're not trying to get into the centre of the city, a car is inherently a very nice solution. You know, it does get from point A to point B very quickly. It's very difficult to design a public transport network that will do it that quickly, very difficult to design it so that we'll do it that conveniently. There are reasons why people choose cars. And these days, you know, relative to a public transport service, particularly, again, in that situation, they're quite a cheap solution. Now, yes, there are carbon issues, although I suspect we will wind up solving those far more in terms of the way that we power cars and in terms of the way that we power our electricity network more generally. I don't think that we should think that the objective here is to kill off cars. Mm-hmm. There's a reason why they're extremely popular. Mm. They do provide for a lot of people, not everyone, and yes, there's issues around social exclusion and so on, but nevertheless, for a lot of people, they do provide a lot of freedom. They work. And so I think one of the issues in transport policy is that we often tend to have, you know, one camp that says it's all about, you know, just build more roads, and then another camp that says it's all about more public transport, instead of saying, you know, really, we're going to have a genuine choice here. And for some people in some situations, indeed probably many situations, cars are going to be an outstanding alternative for a very long time. Now, one of the interesting things that is starting to emerge is that that personalised transport of cars is starting to shift. It's always been, for the last, you know, what, 70 or 80 years, I own my own car, it lives in my garage, and when I want to go from point A to point B, it comes out of my garage and I drive it to point B, and then it stays there until I drive home. And of course, we're moving to a world in which, firstly, there's a lot more taxis, then we're seeing the emergence of Uber-like services, which, interestingly, I've discovered work extremely well in the outer suburbs. It's one of the things that they have quite distinctively relative
really?
To taxis. Yeah, because you can be a part-time Uber driver.
Mm.
You can basically just have it on and someone, you know, basically pops up a job and you think, oh, that's not too far from where I am. So there are people who are, you know, essentially doing it as a part-time job. And so it's much more effective out in the suburbs. Also, the fixed cost of owning the licence is much, much lower, so you can afford to do it part-time. And so that's changing. Then, of course, we've also got the emergence of flexi-rent-type cars, that again are changing the patterns of car ownership. And if Google has its magic way and succeeds in getting driverless cars up and running, then that will again change the game around personalised transport.
So you had a question. Just wait for the microphone to get to you.
Well, one of the ways of improving the experience is to have trains running at far higher frequency than they are at the moment. I mean, I've travelled around Europe, and in metro, you only have to wait 5 minutes for the next train, you know. And I mean, I used to live in Mount Cola in Sydney, and our train service was either 20 minutes or 40 minutes. So if you miss your 20 minutes, you've got a 40-minute wait. I mean, we're building suburbs in the outer areas, and they suffer from the same problems. There is no impetus to change this sort of mentality. The other thing is, I noticed that some of the trains in some of the European cities are automatic. there's I was waiting at in a station in Singapore, and as the train pulled in, there was no driver, and it is a massive transport system in Singapore, extremely good. You can go from the city to the airport for about $3.50. In here, instead, if we want to go to the airport, oh well, you can afford to fly, and we'll charge you accordingly. So anyhow, that's just some of the points.
So how much is the frequency of trains an issue actually from a consumer point of view? Will people choose? Is that one of the issues that people raise, that the frequency one is being an issue?
What people want to do is to be able to get to where they need to be in the time that they have available to travel. Mm. And if that's much, much slower by public transport than it is by car, and you have a parking space and all those things, then obviously the car is more convenient and you'll choose it. So bringing the convenience closer together is to get the right balance between public transport and cars requires, in some cases, more frequency, in some cases, more speed, in some cases, better connections, and then the disincentives for excessive car use, like cutting down parking space, availability of parking spaces.
Does that affect car use?
Yes, that's one of the major drivers. If you know that you can get to where you're going, and the shopping centre has a huge car park, then you'll use
more
your
likely
car
to drive. Yeah.
When I was working in London in a festival, we had a policy not to fly anywhere in Europe, and we had to go, and it was an international festival presenting international companies, so we had to do a lot of travel. And my colleagues and I spent a lot of time on that fabulous European rail network, and it really reconfigured the way that we worked. So we would know that it would take 2 days to travel to Copenhagen from London, and we would be having save up the kind of working stuff that we needed to do in that situation, and have an incredibly intense, fantastic opportunity to do all of that thinking and reflecting that, you know, in your everyday when you're just busy responding to emails doesn't happen. So I think it's all of those things, but I also think there's a way potentially to reconfigure how we work and where we work that might address some of that desire to constantly have everything happen as fast as we want it to happen, which, you know, for whether it's budget or technology, there's always going to be a lag, and maybe there's, you know, another way to enjoy the lag, to make the most of the lag.
Question at the back. Two questions.
Hi, Anhad, did I pronounce your name right?
Yeah.
I just wanted to say thank you, firstly, for your comments you made about the intersection between creativity and public space, because I think it also speaks to public transport as a community hub and as a centre point in cities and in society. For anyone who spent a lot of time on school buses, catching the school bus after school was where you debriefed school with all of your colleagues. So I think public transport's got a really important role to play in society. But I guess I'm curious to ask John and John's, from the academic and institute perspective, how do you go persuading politicians that you're a little bit better informed than them? And how do you go convincing them to go for something, to listen to you guys?
They must be very open to hearing that, yeah. I imagine.
I think one of the things that's really interesting, and I've been watching what's been happening with the community opposition to the East-West Link, and hearing the stories of the Public Transport Not Traffic organisation taking ordinary people from the suburban Melbourne to visit their politicians, and how crucial that has been in the Labor Party's change of heart and their opposition, their public opposition to the East-West Link in the last few months. I'm pretty sure that one of the key things that happened there was they heard from ordinary people in the outer eastern suburbs, the outer western suburbs, who were saying, we can't live with transport system that we have at the moment. We need options. Our kids need options so that they have independence. 20% of the cars on the road are chauffeuring somebody somewhere else. So giving kids the freedom, you talk about the school bus, but it should be there at weekends teenagers, even younger children in European cities, get around on their own because the systems are set up so that they can do that. So I think politicians do respond to hearing the experience of the people that are electing them. We do have to overcome a view amongst quite a lot of politicians, it goes back quite a long way, that, you know, like Maggie Thatcher said, if you're over 24 and you're still in the train, you're a loser. You know, that attitude more or less is there in amongst politicians, where they think, well, real people drive cars. But when they hear the experiences of people, we call it lived experience these days. I don't know why we have to live it to have an experience. But we do now, the people's experience and need for alternatives in transport are becoming a very strong political issue.
Hmm. I think there's two things that particularly help in the way that our politics is working at the moment. One is, in many cases, you can reframe transport as an economic issue. So if you accept that a large number of the jobs being created, not only in Australian cities but globally, are happening in the centre of very large cities, much we'd all love it if there were lots of jobs being created in the regions, but that's not happening anywhere in the world. You know, economic water is essentially flowing downhill, and precisely because face-to-face interaction is so important, we're seeing an increasing number of jobs created at the centre of cities. And therefore, it's an economic issue about how many people can you get into those highly productive areas in the centre of our cities. Now, that's quite a radical reframe. You know, traditionally, public transport's been thought of in many quarters as, well, this is kind of, you know, this is providing a safety net for poor people, if I can, you know, frame it that way. And reframing it as actually, no, this is an economic issue about the productivity of our cities, is often a better way of getting a number of politicians interested. I'm not suggesting that's the only good reason, but I am suggesting it's one that's politically very potent. And actually, you know, it's interesting to note in Melbourne, at least, you know, the dominant users of public transport are, in fact, white-collar workers in the centre of Melbourne. You know, we assume that it's all about, you know, people on low incomes. Actually, you know, try standing outside, you know, Richmond Station sometime and see who's actually on the train. It's a very different game. So that's one way of dealing with it. The other way, and I think this is really important, is you need to frame a lot of these infrastructure choices, as opportunity costs, to use the economic language. The problem is, if you go to people and say, would you like a shiny new east-west link? Their answer will be yes. In the same way that if you say, would you like a shiny new stadium? Their answer will be yes. Because I don't think about, well, what's the alternative? It's only when you say, would you like, for example, an east-west link or a Melbourne Metro railway system? And by the way, just given the state of the budget, it is not realistic that you're going to get both of them over the next 6 years, that you start to get a very different conversation. My suspicion is that one of the major reasons that the east-west road is getting much less public sympathy than most road projects have got in history in Victoria is that, as almost an accident of history, we wound up with two very large projects coming to the fore at the same time, and the public more or less figured out that they weren't going to get both of them, you know, over the next 6 or 7 years, and that therefore they saw the opportunity cost. They figured out, if I get the road, I'm not going to get Melbourne Metro anytime soon, and they know that the system is highly congested in terms of getting into the city, and that's why the project's in trouble. So I think one of the things that we can do politically is actually try and frame up the menu a lot more. And rather than saying you should do Project X, saying, look, realistically, you can only afford one out of the following four things. So which of those four things would you prefer? And that means you're not going to get everything, and that's real life.
But I think the issue goes broader than that in terms of people's understanding of the choices that they're making. Because if you talk to the people out in Frankston, for example, about East-West Link or Melbourne Metro, they say, well, neither of those actually do anything for me. I go to the football occasionally, but otherwise I don't go to the CBD all that often. What I need is a bus, or what I need is a hospital, or what I need is a school. So the budget questions and the choices, and people have a quite sophisticated understanding of the choices that governments have to make, and the idea of a huge project like East-West Link falls over because of a broad range of concerns that people have.
Just another aspect as well in terms of politicians and governments. One thing that is often ignored is the aspect of energy security. So Australia is not really used to that concept because usually a lot of the energy used in the country came from the country itself. But actually now over 90% of the oil that is used in the country comes from imports. And this number is growing. And so setting the country up for an increased dependence on imports from countries that are what they are is not necessarily something that is very strategic.
Barack Obama's tried to do that in the US, but so far the argument hasn't worked. He has tried that argument, but it's not worked.
So they are actually doing a lot of things to increase their energy security, and the U.S. is not the only country who's doing that. So the U.S. has actually implemented very ambitious fuel efficiency standards to do some of this, and they're, as you know, also producing a lot of gas, which is improving their energy security in other
sectors.
Still
quite a hostile environment, though, towards climate change, though, in the United States, wouldn't you say?
Yes, but not towards reducing oil use. Mm-hmm. That is one of the only sectors which actually where everybody agrees that they do not want to be too dependent on oil imports. And a lot of other countries are doing that as well. Europe is now looking at what they can do to reduce their gas dependency. India is looking at how they can reduce also their energy dependency, which impacts their exchange rate, and a lot of countries are looking at this. And people probably don't know it, but oil use is actually the biggest component of all the energy expenditure in Australia. It's about 60% of all the energy spendings in the country. So it's very significant, and all this is dependent on what happens elsewhere. The cost could go much higher up with the resources depleting or any kind of global trends. So being able to move from an oil-dependent system to a system that uses a wider range of fuels and especially electricity, which can be generated not only domestically but also with low-carbon resources, could have a lot of strategic benefits in the future.
I'll come to you in 1 second. So we've got the gentleman at the front who's been waiting a while, at the back rather.
Seems pretty obvious that what you really need is a combination of a very good public transport system based on things like trains and buses, plus the flexibility associated with the individual ownership of cars. However, of course, in today's era, we have to worry about things like climate change, and cars emit a lot of CO2. So isn't it really a question of thinking a bit more deeply about what sort of car technology we should be advocating? For example, people have suggested the idea of electric cars, which would be recharged at the existing service stations connected to the electricity grid, which charges up batteries that you replace from time to time. So if you had a system of generating the base load level of electricity to do this, then you'd be on your way to avoiding a lot of CO2 emission and do something about combating climate change. As to whether renewables would be able to provide that level of base level energy is a questionable issue, but there is, of course, the option of a non-polluting energy source called nuclear power, but I'm afraid my observation is that people in Australia are too stupid to take that option.
Well, I just before the nuclear power issue, I think you have to question the use of non-polluting. I mean, it's not a non-polluting technology. Fukushima shows you that it's not a non-polluting technology. So, I mean, that's a debate that's probably had somewhere else. But I think you're right that we have to get the balance right between, and we have to decide how much travel we have to have by non-car modes, and we do that because even if cars cleared up the air, they tend to create bigger cities, and we can't afford the land mass to have bigger cities. So we have to have more compact cities, and so we have to have more compact mobility technologies. But I'll leave it to the others to talk about how we, for the small or the reduced amount of travel that we do by car, how do we do that most effectively? I'll leave that to the others.
So this is spot on to the project that we recently did, so I'll happily answer this question. In the modelling that we did looking at 2050 and how we could get to zero emissions in Australia, we actually found that indeed for the passenger transport, so cars and so on, one of the best ways to eliminate emissions from this is to move to electric cars, as well as hybrids and plug-in hybrids or hydrogen-powered cars as well, which are all running on electricity mostly. And we found that by 2050, even by adding all of this new demand from the transport sector and some other sectors, we could generate near zero emissions electricity in Australia through a range of different technologies. So we did three scenarios, and we could get to similar levels of emissions and similar cost of electricity with either 100% renewables plus carbon capture and storage, which is a way to absorb the emissions from coal or gas plants, and renewables and nuclear. So Australia actually does have a lot of choices. The country is very rich in resources to generate low-carbon electricity, and so it's not a problem of are we able to do it. It's a problem of we need to act now, and we need to decide what we want for the future. Also, just in terms of emissions in a more short and medium term view, to give you an idea of what we're missing out on with fuel efficiency standards, by 2024, so just in 10 years' time, we could actually have cars that use less than half the fuel that they use today for each kilometer driven. Today in England, people use 30% less fuel to drive the same types of cars just because they have fuel efficiency standards and we don't. So there's different horizons with different technologies, more efficient petrol or diesel-based cars in the short term, and then moving to an electricity-based system in the long term backed up by low-carbon electricity.
Mm. I think there's a lot of technology questions here about what technology is going to work and in particular at what price. And you know, one of the issues with that is we don't really know. The other thing is that you know, we've so far talked a lot about, you know, trying to minimise carbon emissions, trying to minimise the amount of car use, and so on. It's always possible that many of these shifts will be driven by completely different things. So, for example, my guess is that we will see electric car use take off around the world over the next 6 or 7 years, and it will be driven purely by consumer sentiment. It will be driven by the fact that anyone who's driven an electric car says, boy, it is so cool, because it's completely quiet. The acceleration is enormous because you've got a completely different drivetrain because it's an electric motor rather than an internal combustion engine. And because it's an electric motor, it's completely silent. And I've spoken to any number of people who've driven in these things, and they say, I never want to drive any other kind of car again. Now, that's not, in a sense, being done for the right reasons, but nevertheless, it may well drive a change in behaviour. And, of course, one of the things that is terrifying the large car companies of this world is that if they're losing the most profitable and valuable customers, i.e. those who are prepared to pay $120,000 for a car, that's actually a real threat, and they know perfectly well as soon as they lose that market that basically the electric cars will essentially shift down through the price points. So it may well be that we see a shift to electric cars for that reason. Now, of course, one of the big issues is how fast does the battery technology improve so that I can drive 100 kilometres or 200 kilometres or 400 kilometres on a single charge? The short answer to that is we don't know how fast that technology will improve and how cheap the batteries will get over the next 5 or 10 years.
But there are a lot of people thinking about that question.
There's certainly a lot of people thinking about it, and we can certainly see that that's come down a long way. Then there's a second issue, of course, which is how are we going to produce the power for that? Now, my view would be anyone who can tell you what is going to be the cheapest low-carbon emissions technology in 2050 is lying. You cannot possibly know what is going to be the course of technology development over a 36-year period, and in particular what that technology development is going to do in terms of changing costs. To give you an example of how radically things shift, I started working on this kind of problem about which are the best renewables options in Australia 5 years ago. And the answer 5 years ago in Australia was there were any number of technologies that were at least halfway plausible. They included nuclear, they included wind, they included solar thermal, they included solar PV, they included wave and all the rest of it. Roll the clock forward 5 years, and it is very rapidly looking as though solar PV is going to turn out to be a much cheaper technology than all the others. And battery plus solar PV may well turn out to be a great deal cheaper than any other combination of technologies we can see. Now, that's in just a five-year period. We've seen this radical drop in the cost of solar PV panels. And that's one of the things that I think we've got to be careful about in this game, which is you don't want to lock yourself in today, in 2014 in Australia, to any particular technology for the next 35 years. You want to set up a system that encourages the prices and costs of all these technologies to come down, but enables us to basically move to whichever technology turns out to be cheaper.
Okay. This gentleman here has been waiting for a while.
Thanks. Thinking of something that perhaps doesn't depend on technology, interested to know what the panellists think of London-style congestion charge for Australian cities.
Well, let's keep that. We've only got 15 minutes left, so let's keep the answer short and we'll try and get to a few more questions.
That was possible. Ken Livingstone was able to do that because he was taxing the very few people who came into central London by car. Most people came in by tube and were unaffected by it. So the politics of those sort of charges are very difficult to manage until you have the alternatives in place. And then it becomes an option. But I think it's a chicken and egg.
But there are substantial options we've got in Australia already. So one of the issues is that we don't price the networks properly, either public transport or car networks, and in particular we don't congestion price them. So for any economist to see both public transport and road transport is priced exactly the same irrespective of when you travel, that is crazy. So we have tolls on a whole series of roads, and those tolls should be materially higher if you want to travel at peak time and materially lower if you want to travel any other time. Not necessarily.
It seems like such an obvious thing to do, though. Why is that not done?
Well, interestingly, we have done it on the Sydney Harbour Bridge, but the differential's not that big. And the short answer is that if you say to a whole bunch of commuters, you know, we're going to charge you triple the amount you're currently paying in tolls, they'll all scream in unison. So it's hard. And it's even harder on public transport. You know, we should probably... Number one, public transport pricing in Australia is way less than the cost of running it. So the charges in general should probably be a lot higher. But they should be much higher during peak hour. And again, one of the problems is that we say, oh, we can't charge more for public transport because poor people use it. And the answer should be, look, to be really blunt, the vast number of people using public transport in Melbourne between, you know, 7:30 and 9 o'clock are people who can afford to pay a lot more for it and who should be charged a lot more for it than they do pay. And that would tend to kind of spread people who don't need to travel between 7 and 9 o'clock would then choose to travel a little bit earlier or a little bit later. And ideally, you'd actually have a series of steps. You'd make it really expensive between 8 and 9 o'clock and quite expensive between 7 and 8.
I've got a question around the cost of people dying on the roads, because my understanding is that more people die on the roads than through cancer or heart disease, which are the two other biggest killers. And I'm wondering if there's...
Is that true?
No, not anymore. I mean, Victorian road tolls 340 people a year.
But we do pay a cost in health because we spend our time travelling without active health benefits.
I suppose it would be interesting to look at, you know, the joined up circle, which is not just how do we solve that problem of going to A to B, but what those impacts are in across the budgets and where you might go. Well, it, you know, if that was a... There might be a campaign to say don't get in your car for a whole range of reasons other than as well as
climate change. Well, we are starting to change the way we assess road projects, and if we start building in the health costs of everybody driving on our obesity and heart disease and things, then it's going to blow travel time savings out of the water.
So did you say that it is happening already?
It's slowly starting to happen, yeah. But I don't think the transport economists really have their head around how much that would change the game. Mm.
Couple of questions down here. Yes, this lady first.
Hi. Just like to ask, is it John from University of Melbourne?
Yeah.
Yeah. From your experience looking at in Canada, what would work in Melbourne? You said that the populations were fairly similar. What would actually work? Because we have a problem of having a low population in comparison, say, with Europe or Japan or wherever.
Well, if you look at the bus map of Vancouver or the bus map of Toronto, you can have it on a postcard and it makes sense. You try and do that with Melbourne's bus and you can't represent it in that way. You know, an artist might be able to do it, but not in a way that we'd be able to make sense of it. So what they have said is the bus routes will run directly from one station to another station, and you might have to walk a little bit further, but if you do get there, you get into the whole transport network rather than just be taken around the suburbs. That's the basic change that you'd have to make. Yes, in the middle suburbs it would. If you look at the grid network of roads that we have in across Melbourne's middle and even the outer suburbs, we could design our bus system so it was much more. We started to do that with Smart Bus, but it doesn't really take you express. I mean, it still stops at all the stops.
Is there any interest in that from either of the parties or from?
Well, there is interest in it within the public transport agencies. They are starting to think that, but it's a long process of reframing that, and they have to deal with the contracts with individual bus companies who think they have the right to run the bus because their grandfather ran it. And so there's political obstacles, but people are starting to understand that they can have better public transport in the suburbs.
What do the panel people individually, what do you do to have your research, your understanding, your knowledge implemented? I mean, do you work for or contact government departments, decision makers directly to put what you know into work? I mean, Otherwise we've got this process and presumably we go off and vote and it just never happens. The parties are the same.
Quickly, Amandine, because you've had a long project going recently, which is very involved. Yeah.
So I guess we use a number of different avenues. One of them is we try to talk directly to the advisors of the politicians or to the people in the departments that make those decisions to make sure that they're informed and they actually know the choices that they have and the benefits and the risk associated with different options. And the other thing that we do is we actually try to talk to influencers of those politicians. So, for example, consumer associations or business associations of people that could benefit from the changes. For example, companies that would reduce their petrol bills if a policy was implemented, or consumers that would, in the same way, reduce their petrol bills.
Okay.
So, yeah.
Okay. Yes, ma'am. I'm sorry, we've got 7 minutes left, so I think that I'm sure that you would say similar things, trying to talk directly to government departments and trying to speak to influencers. Anything else different?
And speak to voters so that they make decisions for who they vote for that we get rules that can be enforced.
Okay, this is just a brief question. There are health.
Could you speak directly into the microphone?
There are health.
Underneath you, yeah.
Right,
that's it.
Sorry.
That's all right.
There are health costs or health impacts associated with vehicle exhausts, and this hasn't been brought up tonight. So it's not just sitting around in your car and getting obese and cutting, but it's a whole range of illnesses and premature mortality associated with vehicle exhaust. Could someone comment, please?
Yes.
Yes. But it's worth noting it's a much smaller issue in Australia than it is in most places, precisely because we are such a non-dense area of cities, and also because of, obviously the health impacts of that are very dependent on the precise weather patterns that you have and the extent to which it essentially results in those various pollutants being concentrated.
But Australian cities, being on coastal plains, do have weather patterns which intensify pollution.
Yeah, especially Melbourne. But the OECD has come up with the fact that premature deaths associated with air pollution between 2005 and 2010 in Australia have risen 68%. So it might be low compared with other countries, except we're going up, and the majority of OECD countries are going down. And so I think it's a really serious issue.
Yes, sir.
Hi, I just had a question around equity. So I used to live in Bundoora, and I just dealt with, you know, an hour trip in and out every day for maybe four, five, 6 years. I've moved into the city now, and I've got the benefit of, you know, trams, the new bike share and the car share and all that kind of stuff. And now with the government kind of instituting the free public transport within the CBD, it seems to be like there's a bit of a, I guess, inequity between people within the inner suburbs having a lot of access, a lot of choice, and people in the outer suburbs not having so much. And just wondering, is that a problem and how that could be solved?
Well, it is a problem. Certainly it's a problem. And we're also doing the changes that are coming with public transport fares, making it cheaper for people to travel from this outer suburbs is one way of perhaps addressing that, or a pretty blunt instrument to try and address that. But I think the point that one of the other questioners made earlier, the numbers of cars people have to have, the insecure jobs, the pressures that make car ownership for every individual necessary in the suburbs are huge. Mm.
If I can, number one, I think making public transport free in the centre of the city is just plain bad policy. Mm. It is very unfair. It will essentially benefit primarily people who are already doing quite nicely. So it's poor policy, and we should, you know, stand up and say it's bad policy. Secondly, this is where a lot of the planning policy around density actually becomes quite relevant. We would all love to live in green leafy suburbs with nice big house plots and no, you know, three-storey things next to us. And if we are lucky enough to live in those suburbs, that's exactly what we vote for. The problem is that the people who lose out of that are people who don't live there at the moment, and people who otherwise are essentially forced to live on the edge. And one of the things that's gone wrong in our whole planning policy debate is that we're not seeing that the real unfairness that our planning policy creates is all of the people who cannot live in, say, Glen Iris, because we make it really difficult to subdivide it into two or three storey dwellings. And yes, I can understand why the people who live there say, I'd much rather you didn't do that. But the cost of that is borne by everybody else who is forced to live a lot further out. That's actually the really deep unfairness of our planning policy. It means that those suburbs are then much more expensive to buy in than they would be otherwise. And if you look at what divides US cities, which have wound up with, you know, reasonably sensible-looking divisions between high incomes and low incomes, and those where that unfairness is really blown out, it's essentially around planning policy. If you lock up your middle suburbs, and Victoria, Melbourne in particular, has locked up quite a lot of its middle suburbs, made it very difficult to subdivide, then the consequence of that is you get a much bigger divide in practice between rich and poor.
We are almost out of time. Was there one more final question that we have here? Yes.
Hi, thanks. So I just wanted to ask about just general coordination of policy. Are there any states in Australia where there is an integrated view of infrastructure planning, so that we're not just caught up in this three-year electoral cycle and people having thought bubbles in the shower? And I mean, I don't know whether the two options at the moment about I won't even talk about east-west, but the two rail options, how do we know which one is better? But are there any states that are kind of looking at all of the transport and trying to coordinate it and
I don't think there's anywhere that's fantastic, but the best example really is Perth, where people like Alana McTiernan, as the Minister for Transport, made it her mission to keep good quality planning capacity inside the public system rather than privatising everything like we've done here, planning and operations. So there they do have bipartisan support for transport plans. The last election in Perth was fought over, you know, how far the public transport plan would go, not whether we would have one. And so I think Perth does give us some ideas of hope.
All right. Well, just to finish up, I'm going to bring it back to the election that's occupying us all so much. If I could ask each of you for your 30-second reply to what you hope to hear one of the major parties announce tomorrow in terms of their transport policy. Is that, Armandine, can I start with you? Unfair? It's a big question. So,
yeah,
for 30 seconds.
And we look more at federal than state.
Sure.
So, probably creating those choices for people, right? So that there's a better accessibility to public transport and just real choices.
John, you've got anything specific for...
Two things. One is I'd like to see them say we're going to set up an Infrastructure Victoria which provides a really public, disciplined way of assessing transport projects. And secondly, I'd like them to say that they were going to put the price of transport, both road and public transport, up.
Because then you'll never get you'll never get elected.
Yeah, I'm not going to... I might add, I'm not getting elected.
I would love to see a party say we're going to have make some choices about targets and how we're going to give ourselves a public process to reach those targets, which Infrastructure Victoria would be one part of that. And I would also hope that we would, in the planning area, to deal with what might be large population growth in the future, we might have to have some rules and we have to have some teeth on making sure that any development that we do have in the suburbs is not crap, to put it mildly. Mm-hmm. And it's partly the problems in how bad things are, which is why we have such a backlash.
I think I'd like to hear a convincing narrative around a future that I actually want to live in 20 years from now, and that would include how you get from A to B, but also to think about all of those impacts of health and climate and community with it, that should be at the core of all of those, at the core of everything that we're making decisions about, which currently seem to be so split.
That would be lovely. I won't be holding.
I'll vote for them.
All right. Well, look, everyone, thank you very much again for giving up your evening. Thank you for coming. We'll say thank you to Ankara, John, and Amandine. Thank you very much.